Word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All Scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Mark chapter 9, where we are ready to continue with verse 33. All right, the believer finds himself in phase 2, fighting a fight on three distinct fronts. We recognize that we have an enemy in the evil one, that is Satan and those who have aligned themselves with him, particularly the unseen forces, the demons, whom we must combat by being sound in the faith. This is the only thing that is going to save us, because ultimately they seek to attack your thinking. They seek to get you to lower your guard. They seek to get you to compromise with the principles of darkness in order to take you captive. We also recognize that the second enemy is the entire cosmic system, that it is built and run, essentially engineered by Satan himself, and is built on principles of power, of pleasure, money, fame, these types of things, approbation, lust, these things that people do in this world, the way they set the system up. It is designed for the strong to survive and the weak suffer. The third enemy we face, of course, is the enemy, the internal enemy, the sin nature. This is the one we can most effectively deal with and must deal with right now as we begin to approach the Word of God. We recognize that the sin nature is not capable of orienting to God. It is hostile to the plan of God at some level, and so therefore we have to deal with it through the principle of either avoiding it or rebound. So it is time to make sure that you have dealt with that and whatever else you need to do to prepare yourself so that you can focus your attention and concentrate on the teaching today. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for your eternal plan. We thank you for the fact that nothing in your plan is an accident, that you have foreseen all the things that are going to occur, and that indeed have already occurred in human history, and have made every provision for the believer so that we can continue to pursue the objectives of your plan. We recognize that the vast majority of the world system is negative, that they are not interested in you or your plan, but yet your plan continues to advance onward, and those who advance with it will ultimately, of course, become the objects of great blessing. We pray certainly for those blessings, and pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we have here, if you have your map before you, that last color map that was given out, the disciples have been up in the region of Caesarea Philippi. I predominantly assume this is Jesus and the 12, because his goal during this period, of course, has been to spend more private time with his disciples and prepare them. And it says that as they left there, presumably that was the last geographic note we have, so we have to presume that that is where Mark has in view, which would, of course, make Mount Hermon the most likely candidate, and to my thinking, probably the real candidate for the Mount of Transfiguration. But it says they went from there in verse 30 and began to go through Galilee. Now, it's very possible, because there was a trade route, as you see, on the line there, the green one that goes across from Tyre to Caesarea Philippi, there was a trade route in that region. And so they may very well have reversed their tracks, gone back over through the region of Tyre, down through Phoenicia, and arriving on the western side of Galilee, and then, as we're going to see today, eventually making their way back to Capernaum. And we know that during this time, Jesus is insisting upon privacy. He does not want the group to be noticed. So presumably he takes a route that would avoid major cities, would avoid major population centers, so that he could remain incognito as much as possible. Because certainly, as we know, as we saw, that even in the Gentile regions, which up there in Caesarea Philippi certainly was, that Jesus was still known to be in that region, and certainly, of course, people came to see him. So his celebrity preceded him, and he leaves there now. Again, ostensibly, we don't know the exact route he took. I mean, they could have traveled southwest across there, around through Mount Merom there, and gotten back down to Capernaum. But we certainly know that that was the focal point of the journey. And this may very well be, we aren't told specifically, it seems to me here that they go into Peter's house, and this is probably the last time before the crucifixion. There's no indication in any of the other ones that the disciples ever go home again. So we are here now, having moved into the very late part of 32 A.D. or possibly the early part of 33 A.D., and we are not, but maybe a few months before the crucifixion. So here, as we see, they come to Capernaum. We certainly know that that was Jesus' base of operations. And if he was going to remain there very long, it would have been impossible to hide the fact, because people would have known the other apostles certainly in that region. Peter and James and John were local fishermen, and it would appear that Matthew had his seat there as the tax collector's office. So they would have been recognized, and people would have known they were there. So my presumption is here, and it is just a presumption, I mean, I can't prove it, but that they do not stay long, that this is a very brief trip to Capernaum for whatever reason, to make final preparations. I mean, Jesus knows what the itinerary is going to be. They do not. And they, of course, have no idea what's about to happen. Of course, they don't want to know about it either. So now our verse here, as he's made this journey back down out of Gentile territory, returns, and this is the last visit to Galilee as well. And during this time, Mark mentions nothing of any teaching or miracles or anything to that extent. What teaching and miracles are going to occur will not occur in Galilee anymore. They will occur in the lower regions there, through the Decapolis, down even further south off of that map. We've got another map I want to provide for you at some time. Bill had found a couple of good ones. So it shows the region of Perea and Judea to which he's going to be going, and we'll get that map to you here pretty soon. So they came to Capernaum. And as a chi here, of course, it is not translated. Erkomai, the simple verb to come. Aorist indicative, they came or arrived. Into, directional preposition, ice. And this just gives the idea that, of course, the idea of ice is that they moved into the city proper. They were not staying certainly on the outskirts of it. And they were not avoiding the crowds at this point to the extent that there were any there. But if they came in late in the evening or something, maybe after dark, it's a very good possibility that they went to the house and no one even knew they were there. That's one option. So they came into the city, though, and in the house became, literally. Actually, what you have here is the aorist deponent participle of genomai, the verb to become, which indicates a change of state or status. And they became, literally, having become or having entered. Genomai means to become, but the idea here is entering. Having entered into the house. Preposition en plus the locative of hey, oikia. And because the definite article is used, it seems to me that this is a house of some familiarity and would very likely, again, be Peter's house. We know that Jesus was very much at odds with his family at this point. They were not supportive. His brothers are unbelievers. His mother's very confused. There's questions about his sanity that they have not fully resolved. And now, if they had got wind of this new teaching, which there's no indication that they had at this point, but if they got wind of this new teaching that Jesus is talking in terms of martyrdom, this would not have made them any more happy. This would have upset them even further. So it seems to me, most likely, again, the house in view was probably Peter's. He began to question. You can probably tell this is an imperfect because, once again, they've supplied began here. Eperotao, E-P-E-R-O-T-A-O. Again, erotao means to ask a question. Eperotao is a strengthened form of it. And so this has an idea of when one's asking a question, they're not just asking a single casual question. It's intensive at some level. It's designed to get to the bottom of whatever issue that they are seeking to discuss. And there is some, and the imperfect indicates again that he probably asked several of them, not just one of them. Because, as we're going to see, they didn't really want to talk now. So he began, of course, or he was questioning them. Them would be the 12 specifically at this point, I believe. Plural of autos, third person plural. What were you discussing on the way? Pretty tough question. They knew what they were talking about, but they didn't want to answer. You got the interrogative pronoun tis, who, what, or which. And again, because it's a neuter, we would say that which or what. Which is how they've translated it here in the New American Standard. What? On the way, preposition N plus the word hadas with the definite article. This means a way, a road, or a path. On the journey, even it can, by metonymy, it can mean the trip you took. What were you discussing on the way? And then the verb here, imperfect, deponent, indicative, dialogizomai, indicates, because it wasn't imperfect, dialogizomai. And so this has the idea, logizo has the idea of reasoning or thinking about something. Dia means to think through it, hence to explore it. It can mean, again, to ponder something, to discuss it, depending upon how, if there's any element of hostility or conflict, the word can even mean debate or argue. And I would assume that this was probably tending towards that direction, although they may have not gotten really heated with one another. Each one of them had their own opinion. And each one of them was, you know, no doubt articulating it. And so as they discussed this and debated, the only thing they're thinking of is in terms of who's going to be great in the kingdom. What am I going to get? How am I going to be better than you guys? And, of course, this is just the opposite of the way Jesus needs them to think, but they don't, you know, obviously don't get it. So the imperfect, again, indicates that this discussion went on for some time on the trip. It was not just that they mentioned it once, but they were talking about it right along. Now, perhaps Jesus overheard them on the way. We don't really know. Perhaps this is a function of his omniscience where God, the Holy Spirit, just provided him the information. Or he, as we know, apparently could use his the issues of his deity, his attributes, but never to benefit himself. And this obviously is not a situation that benefits him in any way, as he would find out this information. But as with all good authorities and communicators, God gets him the information when he needs it, and so Jesus at this point chooses to deal with this because this is so counter to what he has just been teaching them about denying yourself. And as we're going to see, we're going to get another extended lesson here on their need for humility, which they did not have at this point very much of. So, but they kept silent. For on the way they had discussed with one another which one of them was greater. But is the mild adversative or weak adversative duh here. But they, a nominative masculine plural, here it would refer to the 12. Kept silent is siopao. S-I-O-P-A-O. This word's only used 10 times. It means to refrain from talking, hence to keep quiet or silent. That should be or silent. So it has the idea of, you know, there was probably some fair amount of conversation going on in the house. Certainly by now when they're in the house, there are other people around. That's another issue. They might not want to have had all these people here. I'm presuming Peter's family's there and the children, if he had any, which it would seem maybe he did. We certainly know he was married. And by that, you know, we would expect that he had children, in fact. But they, again, you just have the definite article there, the nominative masculine plural referring back to them in context. And the last time we actually got them identified was back up in verse 28. And that was when they were still in or around Caesarea Philippi. But they were clearly defined there, the disciples. Well, this definite article just points back to that same identification. It's the article that references them. For, or because, is the explanatory conjunction gar here introducing the reason why they suddenly don't want to talk. For with one another or toward one another, you've got the preposition pros plus the reflexive allelon. A-L-L-E-L-O-N. Allelon, this means to one another or toward one another. With is the way they've translated here because it's in the context of a discussion, which is fine. With one another. Then you've got dialegomai, which is a slightly different word, which means to talk through. D-I-A-L-E-G-O-M-A-I. Lego means to speak or say. And dia, I mean through. So they had been talking through this, and the idea here is that what they've done is translated by the word discussed. With one another, along the way or on the way. Preposition in plus, again, hadas, the way, the trip. Who is greater? And the idea here, the New American Standard translates it like it's a superlative, but it's actually just a comparative. The idea, of course, is who. Here you've got tis now, the interrogative, but now it's a nominative masculine singular. It's not a neuter, so we don't translate it like a what or which. Here you would translate it like a human was in view, because they are. Who was, and then you've got the comparative of megas. Who is greater? And there's no discrete verb, so you would supply the to be verb here. They were discussing who was greater. I'm greater than you are. No, I'm greater than you are. No, I'm better, and I'll tell you why. I'm up here, and you're down there. That's why I'm greater, see. I'm smarter than you. Jesus picked me first. Jesus gave me a nickname. He didn't give you a nickname. So don't think you're better than me. Jesus took me and Peter and John up on the mountain. He didn't take any of the rest of you, numbskulls. So this could get out of hand pretty quick when you have people who are, in a sense, acting very childishly. And when you're concerned, and this becomes one of the fundamental problems, of course, with believers that have to deal with this, and that is when you're overly concerned with yourself, you're probably going to act childishly. And we've all done it. We are all adults, but we've all done childish things and acted in childish fashion. Well, these guys have got it down pretty good here. They basically are concerned with, again, their place in this deal and what can they get at, what's in it for them. And there's, again, at some level in the Christian life, that's not a bad thing. That the believer concerns himself with, well, what am I going to have at the end of all of this? What is in it for me to serve God? Some people say, well, that's not a spiritual question. Well, I don't know. I pretty much do that about everything in life. I don't just say, like what would be in it for me last night to go up to Tampa and watch that game? What's in it? Nothing. An hour drive, overpriced tickets, and a losing team. Wow. How exciting for me. So I didn't go. And I turned the TV off pretty quick once the game started. Because, you know what, it wasn't good. But you kind of learn to expect. Well, I approach everything in life like that at some level. I mean, what's in it for me? I mean, that's normal human behavior at some level. That we wonder, okay, well, if I do this, you know, if I take this job, if I take this whatever it is, situation, what is in it for me at the end of the day? And if it's not worth your while, well, guess what? You probably won't do it. Or if you don't deem it to be worth your while. Now, of course, they've got this all wrong because they're looking at it from a purely selfish perspective. They've not gotten beyond just the... And because later on, they will ask the question, what's in it for us? And Jesus answers them. He doesn't rebuke them for asking that. He answers them and tells them what's in it for them. So the question itself isn't necessarily bad, but... the way they're approaching it, that it's all about me. And those of us who it is actually all about, that irritates us when people think like this. So it's not all about any of us. That's kind of a joke, of course. It's not about any of us at that level. The plan of God, we're part of it, but the sun doesn't rise and set on us as much as, you know, you might want to think sometimes. All right, well, point one here, it is clear from the synoptic accounts that the apostles had become somewhat reticent to question Jesus about things they did not understand. Now, we see they've kind of done a back and forth here. On some things they won't ask him, and other things they still ask him. But it appears that they ask him only about those things that they don't believe he can turn on them. Although, when they did ask him here just recently about why could we not cast this out, he basically says, well, because you don't have enough faith. So that kind of turns on them too. And even when they do ask him questions, very often the answer isn't what they would like, let's say. And it isn't necessarily always favorable to them. So too, however, it will become apparent that they certainly were not restrained when they interacted with one another. Matthew's account contains the record of an event that is not recorded by Mark or Luke. Now that's Matthew 17, 24 through 37. We'll have to look at that. Because this event is not mentioned in either of the other accounts. Matthew 17 and 24, when they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? And he said, "Yes." Of course, then he answers without knowing, but that's Peter. And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?" And Peter said, "From strangers." And Jesus said to him, "Then sons are exempt. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea, throw in a hook, and take the first fish that comes up. And when you find its open, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for you and me." And so this is just an account on one of the things we see here in the life of Christ that's taught, for instance, in other passages like Romans 13, is orientation to the establishment chain of command. Jesus was not a revolutionary in that sense. He was a law-abiding citizen, and what was incumbent upon him, he performed. I would like to be able to pay my taxes in this way, but I'm not. So obviously he's still got to provide some other way. The fact that he provided miraculously there for him and Peter should, you know, let us know, hey, he'll provide for us. Well, however, all 3 accounts contain somewhat differing versions of this pericope. That is, again, just a short section out of a text that deals with, say, a particular issue or a couple of particular issues. It's just a small section in which Jesus provides a lesson on humility. Now, Matthew 18 is actually parallel to ours. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child to himself and set him before them. And he said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And then we have our passage in Mark and then Luke also in Luke 9. Verses 46 through 48. And here, when we put these passages together, we get a fuller picture of what's going on. Luke 9, 46. "An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart..." Here we have the specific here from Luke, we're told that this information was provided supernaturally to Jesus. He didn't necessarily hear them. He was reading their tape. And he's manifested this before. We saw that back in the earlier part of Mark when he knew what those Pharisees were sitting there thinking. "Why are you reasoning thus in your heart? Which is easier to say?" Well, they're both easy to say if you can do them. And he does the same thing. "He took a child and stood him by his side. And he said to them, 'Whoever receives this child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you, this is the one who is great.'" And so we'll get some other incidents that take place during this time as well. Well, although Luke does not provide the setting for this incident, both Matthew and Mark indicate that Jesus and the apostles, and perhaps now even a larger group of disciples, again, we pointed out that possibly he had joined up with a group, another group, or people were joining him as he went, but we can't say for certain. But we certainly know the 12 were there, had returned to the city of Capernaum. Again, this had been very much his base of operations. His home was there. Peter's home was there. Matter of fact, maybe all of them lived in Capernaum. We don't know. We certainly know that 4 of them did, the 4 that we're told about. Well, 5, both Mark and Luke agree that the discussion, debate, argument, however you want to look at it, began on the trip back to Capernaum. It is very likely that this conversation took place out of Jesus' hearing. Simply, I say that because the information's apparently, he gets it supernaturally. And plus, it would not behoove them, and I think they would know this, don't discuss this in front of the teacher about who's the greatest, because that probably is not going to set well with him. They had some idea, I think, of the impropriety of what they were doing. And so when people are doing improper things, guess what? They try to keep it secret. They don't really want to run around and broadcast it. They don't want anybody to know what they're going to do on certain occasions. That's one of the things you can tell I've observed over the years with believers, and particularly if they're starting to go negative. They'll become very secretive. They'll start trying to hide things. They won't talk to other people any longer. They'll start clamming up. I've seen that multiple times. So, but this appears to have all again take place out of his hearing, as they would recognize, you know, he's not going to want us doing this. Well, six, this is consistent with what we know of the apostles at this time. They would not have wanted to do anything in Jesus' presence that might cause him to react. And seven, Luke indicates that Jesus perceived what was going on within these men, which must be a function of his omniscience. While Mark indicates that Jesus began to quiz the apostles after they arrived in Capernaum. Well, again, when people ask questions, there's two reasons people ask questions. They ask questions because they either don't know and they're trying to find out, or they already do know. And then when they ask the question, they're just letting you tell them what they already know, in fact. And so Jesus already knows what they're talking about. The fact that Mark has him quizzing them isn't inconsistent with this. Some look at this and they say, well, there's a conflict, see? Jesus knew already, so why did he ask? There are certain situations in which you ask questions like that. That's the way you handle certain situations. Well, Matthew pictures the disciples coming to Jesus and initiating the conversation. But this appears to have been some of the others accompanying Jesus and the 12, not just the apostles. Now, assuming that they did hook up with some other people along the way and that people had joined them, and certainly we know by now Peter's family would be here in the house, and whatever extended family might be there or around there may have entered as well. We don't really know for sure who all's here. But it is more than just the 12 by this time. That much I'm pretty certain on. So therefore, it would seem that the apostles were arguing about who was the greatest on the way to Capernaum. Jesus perceived what was happening, but waited for a more opportune time to address the subject. And perhaps even waited for a wider audience. We don't know that wasn't in his thinking as well, that he might have been looking for more people there. Well, 10, although we are not told specifically into which house Jesus entered, the use of the definite article suggests that it was a house that had been previously mentioned. This would indicate that it belonged to Peter. That's the one, or to Matthew. We do know there were two houses that he had been in, certainly. And it appears that one of these, Peter's, I think, well, Matthew was pretty well-to-do, so they both may have had fairly large holdings there. We really don't know. Peter's house was certainly large enough to accommodate his family and extended family, that Andrew lived with him as well. And his mother-in-law lived with him, so we don't know how many people actually were in that house, but it would seem that it was sizable enough to accommodate them. So Mark 1:29 is the first time we're told about that. And immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. And then in 2:15, we're told about when he was reclining at the table in his house. And that his house there would be Matthew's in context. So, and again, it's the other apostles, you know, very likely lived, if not in this region, around there somewhere. And so, you know, it could have been anybody's house. But my guess is Peter's at this point. 11, the use of the imperfect form of the verb eperotao indicates that Jesus did not ask a singular question, but was inquiring of multiple people. Well, probably, and we know why, because they weren't really answering him. So the question would be turned then to someone else. What were you talking about? No habla Aramaic. You know, whatever dumb way they tried to get out of it. I mean, you can picture this with people sitting there, grown men, sitting there and sitting on their hands. Oh, boy, the walls are really straight today. Whatever they were trying to do to get out of this, because they didn't want to answer the question. So Jesus asked, I think he probably had to ask it 3 or 4 times. Finally, of course, somebody, you know, owns up to it. They don't want to. But they finally do. Well, 12, although the New American Standard tends to treat many imperfects as having aggressive force, they often supply the words "began to." The real emphasis of the form is on durative or repeated action in past time. Obviously, with any action, you can supply "began to" with any verb, because obviously the action has to begin at some point. But is that the focus of the verb? And they seem to read all imperfects as having aggressive force. So I'm not sure why. I think that might have just been one of their little translation biases. Well, 13, Jesus does not seek to avoid this issue because it might be upsetting or embarrassing for the apostles. Rather, he confronts them and makes certain that everyone understands the matter of true greatness in God's plan. And that's what they don't get at this point. I mean, their views on all this are wrong. They're misguided. They're arrogant. They are in conflict with one another. They're combative toward one another. They, as we're going to see coming up here later in chapter 10, James and John try to do an end around against all of them. So they go to Jesus privately and say, "Hey, well, we only want one thing, really. You know, we just want to be the greatest. That's it. Just do that for us and we'll be fine." Well, this ticks off the other apostles. They're angry about it. And, you know, and some, you know, Peter may have been really angry, like, "Hey, we all three always go on this stuff. Why'd you leave me out?" Who knows what he was thinking, but it's clear that they were combative with one another. And so this is not a group that at this level, if all things remain just the same as they were right now at this point in history, where they were, they never would have made it. This group would have imploded. So, again, we want to keep a good balance, I think, with the apostles when we deal with them, because they do overcome all of this stuff. And again, why does Mark record all of this? I believe the purpose is to encourage believers that are less than perfect and can sometimes be childish and stupid themselves, that look, the apostles themselves were failures, great failures in the beginning, and they made it. So therefore, we can outgrow our stuff and we can make it too. It would be one of the reasons, I would assume, for writing. Well, 14, based on the apocryphal gospel of Thomas, some have suggested that the disciples recognized that death was a real possibility and were wondering who would lead the group after Jesus' departure. And that quote comes out of, again, the apocryphal books are those that are not canonical. So we do not look to them as authoritative, but this maybe throws some light on some of their thinking, possibly. We will at least acknowledge it's a possibility. The disciples said to Jesus, "We know that you are going to leave us. Who will be our leader?" Well, I can tell you that's not inspired just by the very statement itself. Now, they may have wondered that, but they weren't thinking about in terms of his leaving and being killed and resurrected. They didn't accept any of that. So, again, this is apocryphal. That's why, because it's not inspired by God. But there are many writings like this that existed during that time. Some of them made their way into the King James Version, the apocryphal books, but we reject them as not being canonical. And things like this, I mean, yeah, while this might be an interesting thought, did it ever really happen? And were they even thinking in these terms at that time? And I don't think they were. Well, 15, however, it is more likely that recent events prompted this discussion. The recent failure of the nine, coupled with what would appear to be favoritism towards Peter, James, and John, likely resulted in bruised egos for some and a feeling of superiority on the part of others. And so, I don't have any problem seeing Peter, James, and John doing their superior dance. That we're better than you guys. Jesus gave us nicknames, Sons of Thunder. Well, that's not a compliment. Petros might be considered to be somewhat complimentary, I mean, in the context in which it's uttered, but certainly Sons of Thunder never was. And so, the reality is, they think they're better, no doubt. And the others, again, they're bruised. Their egos are bruised. They've been publicly humiliated. And now how long this entire trip back to Capernaum took, we're not told. I mean, it could be measured in terms of days. They could have done this quickly. Could be measured in terms of weeks. But Jesus might have, you know, taken a real circuitous route as he was going through Galilee. Well, 16, additionally, it might have been only, it had been only slightly more than a week previous. That Jesus had spoken of Peter in terms of glowing condemnation. Again, it's very difficult here to give you full chronology because I don't know how long this all took. But we do know that from the time of Jesus, of Peter's confession there in Matthew 16, we can certainly say 8 days had passed, as we know, because we're told that about the transfiguration. Now, how much more time has passed between the time they come back down that mountain the next day and they get actually back to Capernaum? It's hard to say. It could just be days. It could be, again, it could be a few weeks. But one thing's for certain. It hasn't been all that long ago that Peter talks about Jesus talks about Peter in these glowing terms. Matthew 16, 17 through 19. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. That's Bar Jonah, just as the Aramaic form for Bar means son. It's the equivalent to the Hebrew Ben. Simon, son of Jonah. Because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father is in heaven. Well, now, how do you think Peter's feeling and the rest of them when he hears it? Oh, God's communicating directly with Peter. Well, that's what anybody would have thought when Jesus utters this. Oh, so Peter's got some in with God. Well, how do you think that makes Peter feel? Superior, right? I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. And then again, he warns them not to tell them that he's the Messiah. Well, B, it would appear that the blessing pronounced on Peter implied a higher level of spiritual authority than that of the other apostles. The words of Jesus certainly suggested that Peter alone would have a foundational role in his church. Now, how did they interpret ecclesia here? I don't know that they had no idea what he was talking about. They couldn't have known. I've got to believe that they're only looking at it in terms of the kingdom itself, a kingdom-type setting in which there's a king, Jesus, and those who work under him, those who are his chosen ones. So, but the fact that he says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, he didn't say, blessed are the rest of you. He just said, blessed is Peter. Well, you can, okay, so all right, I single one person out in Bible class and say, this is a really great believer. How, you know, do they feel then, how would that person feel? How would the other people feel? Well, I apply. You know, you can see where these types of statements could generate controversy and conflict. Well, B, it is evident from the Greek of verse 19, the dative of the pronoun sou is singular, that Peter alone is given the promise of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Now, that doesn't, you can't tell in English because we don't have a discrete form for the you. You can be singular or plural, you or you all. Well, in the Greek, it's very clear, it's singular. I give to Peter the keys of the kingdom. So now Peter recognizes, and certainly the keys to the kingdom imply some level of authority in the kingdom that these other guys don't have necessarily. So how does this make all them feel? Well, obviously it would seem that Jesus was very expressed favoritism towards Peter in a big way. And then you got the deal of the transfiguration, which they haven't told anybody about yet, and apparently they never do until after the resurrection. They were at least obedient on that. But you've got that situation. Then you have the situation with Jairus' daughter when Peter, James, and John were singled out for favoritism again. And this seems to be something that goes on relatively regularly in Jesus' ministry. But now, we know Jesus is not playing favorites. So why he does this, and there are obvious reasons, personalities, relative level of positive volition, relative level of understanding. But we see that even on the insiders, we have distinguished, you know, back in Mark there earlier in chapter 4, that you've got the outsiders and you've got the insiders. And the insiders are certainly the 12 and other apostles, the 12 and even some other disciples who are around consistently enough with Jesus to be considered part of his group. Those on the outside, well, they get everything in parables and unclear teachings and things that do not lend themselves to readily being understood necessarily. But even among the insiders, we see that even among the insiders, they were like the super-duper insiders, the three specifically. And but we see that these show no more insight than those did. And on many occasions, they show no more insight than these people did. So being on the inside wasn't any, quote, guarantee of anything spiritually at that point. And certainly one could make the argument that Judas was one of the insiders, even though he's an unbeliever. He's certainly there for everything and is certainly part of the major key group of apostles. Well, 17, given what we know of Peter's personality, the reader may reasonably conclude that he allowed these blessings and promises to further inflate his view of himself. And this happens when people are complimented or singled out for some whatever, even just a statement here, that this gets to their egos in certain occasions. And they begin to think more highly of themselves than they should. Well, I think this isn't unique to Peter here, although Peter probably exemplifies it. I don't think it's unique to him. I think the other guys have similar problems, very much so. And this is why these arguments are erupting from time to time. Well, 18, this undoubtedly led to some verbal or overt manifestation of the fact that he regarded himself as superior to the other apostles, which may well have been the catalyst for the debate, discussion, argument that ensued on the trip. Who knows if it was generated by Peter alone or if all, the bruised ego guys, hey, we're not second-class citizens just because we couldn't handle that. You know, and they start defending themselves. And all of these things, none of this to me smacks of anything other than normal human nature. That this is the way people act. And what we see here is the way people typically will act. Well, 19, although Mark only records the argument in general terms, who was greater, Matthew adds the qualifying phrase, in the kingdom of heaven, in 18:1 there. 20, the recent event on the Mount of Transfiguration, along with all the talk about resurrection, which the disciples would likely have connected with the last judgment, would certainly have suggested to them that the kingdom was at hand. There's nothing here that's going on, even in spite of Jesus' teaching to the contrary, that would get them to thinking, well, the kingdom of heaven's a long way off. We don't need to worry about it. Their feeling was it was imminent, that it was at hand. It was ready to be manifested. And they were ready to have their positions within that kingdom. And so the fact is, they feel very entitled. They feel very arrogant. They know they've got these great positions on the inside. And they want all they can get out of this. Which, again, at one level, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's healthy to want to achieve. And to want to, to not just simply, go with the status quo all the time. But then the way you go about it and the motivation behind it, that all has to be factored in as well. And they're going about it all wrong, and their motives are wrong. So pretty much here, they're acting like idiots. And Jesus knows they're acting like idiots, and he's going to point out, you're acting like idiots. And you're going to keep acting like idiots until you humble yourself. And that's your big problem, or at least one of your big problems. Well, 21, the Jewish belief, which was expressed throughout many of their writings, was that there were certainly going to be class distinctions in heaven. Even within the elite of Jewish rabbis, there would be distinctions due to learning and merit. As recorded in Baba Batra there in the 75a, this teaches the Holy One, blessed be He, will make everyone a canopy corresponding to his rank. There, using the analogy of the tabernacles feast, that God would build each one a booth, as it were. Now Jesus goes on farther, way beyond all this, when he says, "In my Father's house there are many dwelling places." Well, by the way, they're not booths either, made out of palm fronds. I think when you see the New Jerusalem and the dwelling places of the church, you're going to think, "Yeah, this is something better than a booth." I'm intentionally underselling it here. But when you read about it, we can't do it justice. But the massive size of it, it's 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles, a cube or a pyramid, depending upon how one sees it. Well, it's huge. And it's glorious. And we see it talked about in terms of precious stones and gold and valuable metals and these types of things. Well, it's not going to be just a booth, a bare minimum. What did you get in heaven? Well, I got a little wooden shack out back. Well, that's not good then. Now, that will say something about your rank. And see, all these things factor together into when we start talking about your surpassing grace rewards, eternal rewards, and your distinction in heaven. Just like people here maintain distinctions even by the place they live. All houses are not the same. If you ever, you know, drive out along Longboat Key, you'll probably say, well, that's not like my house. Or, you know, some other exclusive, you know, gated community or wherever. And I watch them, you know, I'll see them. I watch a lot of the travel shows and, you know, Anthony Bourdain's one of my favorite because he's so snarky. But when he's in some of these places, I mean, he shows some of these places and I'm just like, you're just astonished at people. Oh, I've got a 90,000 square foot home. Well, that's pretty good size. That's a pretty good size house. How, God, who cleans it? Well, even the Jewish rabbis acknowledge this concept, which is taught in the New Testament. There are going to be class distinctions in heaven. There will be people who get there with nothing but the smell of smoke on them. All their stuff's burned up at the bema seat, but they're still believers. He himself will be saved, yet so as by fire. And then there are going to be people who have great distinction and great reward and all that. So that's what they believed is true. And it's funny, when the more I've studied Mark, and the more I've considered, because I didn't really spend much time until you get to the Gospels, when you're having to deal with the scribes and the Pharisees and the rabbinic thinking of that time, the teachers, when you get into this, you realize, or I have, that they had the basic right idea about a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm stunned at how much they actually had right, except they're going about it all wrong. And that's kind of what Paul says there in Romans. He said they had the right idea, but they went about it all wrong. They went about it as though it was by works and not by faith. But and when you examine, and now some of their beliefs are very weird, like we saw that deal for how do you heal a flow of blood. I mean, God, it really, literally, it was like a Monty Python deal. And in this, they get absolutely right. There'll be class distinctions in heaven. And So this is the nature of what you get out there, and this is why, as we warn people, you have to be careful what you expose yourself to, because some of it may be good, and it may be real good, and some of it may just be really, really horrible. And so you have to be kind of careful, as Jesus warned. He told, you know, said, be careful what you listen to, what you hear, and how you hear as well. Well, 22, the use of the imperfect of the verb dialogizomai, discuss or debate, also means that this was not merely a brief question and answer among the apostles. This discussion went on for some time. In 23, the verb has the idea of thinking or reasoning carefully. It is used of considering a matter in detail. And the cognate noun, dialogismos, has a decidedly negative nuance in the New Testament. Mark 7:21, that one... when you see it, and this was in the context of the sin nature, so you can imagine it's not a good thing when he's defining what comes out of the sin nature. And the first thing out of there, from out of the heart of men proceed the evil thoughts. That's dialogismos. And so when you get to that term, the noun has a pretty much decidedly negative connotation in the New Testament, whereas the verb can cover everything from a quiet, normal discussion to a heated argument. So it covers a lot of ground. Well, 24, therefore the reader should understand that this was not merely a jovial discussion about who was greater. I mean, these guys aren't laughing and patting each other on the back as they're discussing this. You know, they're trying to stab each other in the back as they're discussing it, is more the idea. Rather, these men were arguing back and forth about their relative greatness. 25, the comparative form of the adjective megas, greater, can be used with the force of a superlative when comparing two or more objects. For instance, Matthew, in the parallel, Matthew 18, 1 uses it there. Yeah, my zone, it's a comparative there. And also 18:1, who is the greatest? And 23:11, also in Matthew. But, and again, you hear you have, the term is actually a comparative in all these. But the greater among you will be your servant. And so Jesus talks in terms of relative levels of greatness. But relative levels of greatness are not determined the way they think that they are. The apostles think greatness is based on all the wrong things, when in fact greatness is based on humility and service. And that's not them right now, by any stretch of the imagination. That is not them. They are not humble, and they do not think about serving one another. In fact, right up until the very last night, they are so resistant to this that Jesus gets up and takes the form of the servant and washes their feet. Because all of them were sitting there thinking, I'll be darned if I'm getting up and washing anybody's feet. I'm not humbling myself like that. That's a job for a slave, not for me. I'm too good to do that. And Jesus gets up and proceeds to humiliate him by showing him that he's not too good to do it. And to what impact this lesson had on them, you can only wonder. But when you read it and you study it, it becomes very clear that they should have been humiliated. That their Lord and Master was willing to humble himself, but they weren't willing to humble themselves. That they should have gotten. Well, 26 here, Mark alone records the fact that Jesus' question was met with a wall of stony silence from those that had been involved in the debate. None of the other guys mention that. Matthew and Luke, neither one of them mentions that. And again, this is consistent with the fact that Mark's gospel portrays the disciples in as bad a light as any of them, or in worse light most of the time than any of them. But of course, Peter's got all these memories. And very much as we know, again, Mark is it's been the orthodox consensus for decades, for centuries, that Mark represents Peter's thinking on all this. That Peter was the eyewitness to this stuff, and so that you have eyewitness. And that this really smacks of an eyewitness, somebody that was there too, that said, now Matthew was there, but he doesn't record it. Now Luke never was there. Of course, Luke's a Gentile physician. Well, 27, the verb siopao means to refrain from speaking, to be silent, or to say nothing. As in Mark 3:4 there, where he confronts the Pharisees. And it isn't as though they had said anything at this point, because they're just watching him, as it says. There's no indication that they've made any sort of a public comment at this time in chapter 3, verse 2. Now, they were watching him to see if he would heal. And he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill? But they refrained from speaking. They kept silent. And they just never uttered a word. And it wasn't as though they had been talking and quit talking. They just never spoke in that context, it appears. Whereas the disciples, in this case, had been talking and quit. It is also used to denote the disruption of speech in progress, or becoming silent, as in Mark 10:48. We'll see that coming up in the following chapter. And here it's actually used in the form of a command. Many were sternly telling him to be quiet. Stop talking, quiet. And he of course he wouldn't. But he kept crying out all the more. The more you try to tell me to be quiet, the more I'm going to holler. And so they didn't get, the silence wasn't brought forth there. Well, 28, in this case, if anyone was talking about anything, that conversation came to a sudden halt, and no one said another word. Even Peter, who always seems to be talking, apparently had nothing to say. In 29, it is most probable that their refusal to speak was born out of the fact that they were embarrassed about the matter. It is likely that they sensed that their conversation about who was greater was inappropriate, and that Jesus would not be pleased by such behavior. 30, see, that's one of the things, that people have these little bracelets, what would Jesus do? Well, he wouldn't sit around and argue about that. I think they probably put, they could have looked down at their bracelet and seen it. But that's the whole point. Again, very often in the presence of any sort of authority, people will pull their horns in and rein in their STA because they know that authority might come down on them. And I suspect they knew Jesus would not be happy with this at all. Well, 30, Mark records this using the same vocabulary that he had used earlier of the Pharisees. The apostles' guilt and shame here are the result of a similar hardness of heart. They're not exactly like the Pharisees, of course, but we've already been told by Mark point blank that their problem is their hardness of heart. That their refusal to change and listen to the new information and orient to it and gap it. They didn't. Well, 31, these men lived in a culture that emphasized the ideas of rank, precedence, and privilege. And they demonstrate that they think and operate in a very similar manner to their cosmic counterparts. And this is the way the world works. As we talk about the world, the cosmos, the world system, people try to get to the top. They want to be the head honcho, the big cheese. Nobody wants to start. And you'll see people like this. I've met them all my life. People who think they're too good to start at the bottom and do a job and learn from the ground up. And people that think like that, I don't have any real use for them, frankly, because they're not humble and you can't really teach them very much. And you got to be willing to do the most menial thing. That's, again, as we pointed out, there is no unimportant work. They're just people who think they're too good to do it. All work has value. All work has merit. Say, we don't teach our kids, to aspire to, serving fries at McDonald's. You probably want to do better than that when you grow up if you can. But, when I want some French fries, I'm glad there's somebody there doing it, making them. And don't give me the lecture on break about shouldn't eat McDonald's French fries. Good God. I'm still alive. I know junk food's not good for you. I get it. But you probably don't want to tell your kids, well, I want you to aspire to garbage collection because that's a real... first, you've always got a job. I mean, it's a guaranteed line of work. There'll always be trash. And, and it'll only get worse. Well, we don't want to tell them to, set their sights too low. But on the other hand, we have to kind of teach our children, look, we're different than the cosmic view of this world. We don't act the same way. We don't have the same priorities. We go along in our life, you pray about things, get your education, grow up, see where God leads. You can have some ideas about what you want to do, but you've got to always be willing to commit everything you're doing to God, and is this what you want? And if it's not, well then stop it. God, give me direction as to where I need to be in life and what I need to do. Well, these guys aren't like that at all. They've determined, they've laid out their course, they've got their thoughts, and they aren't changing them. But again, this is part of their problem, their unwillingness to confront this and change. Well, Mark 10:42, he called them to himself, and he said, that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them, but it is not this way among you, or at least it's not supposed to be. It's not going to be if you're going to do this properly. All right, well, time is gone. Let's stop there. I almost got through that, but we will go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break and then pick up here at 5 after.